Okay, so first I want to thank our organizers and here to have us here. The ATP has always been an interesting place to have a look of how science is done. I always joke with people, always have mixed feelings about the ATP. Sometimes it's basically exactly how this thing is basically. Sometimes I believe that doing this program is absolutely chaotic. Sometimes doing this program is the best way of getting people together. So what I'm going to try to do today is a little bit of using the first half an hour to give an overview of what I call energy landscape theory and why we believe that's a new way of looking at protein folding and what that has added to the conventional way of people have been looking at the protein folding. And then the last part, I'm going to show a little bit of the different kinds of simulations and models that we have been doing at different levels of representation of the protein. Start from very simplified models and going to all animal simulations with full solvation and give people, without details, at least a taste of what's going out there in terms of these things. So even before I start, I want to say that basically what I'm presenting is a mixture of a story that involved a lot of people. Basically, the first person who started with me in 1992 was Peter Leopold, when we came with the idea of introducing the idea of protein folding funnels. After that, I think I want to say Nick Sochi has been doing a lot of the supporting work on that, I want to say. In parallel with that, we had a big collaboration. Here's the wrong address. Peter is with us in San Diego now, so you can see this transparency is old. Peter Wallace has been around. A lot of the recent stuff we'll be talking about is work done by Hunemeyer, John Shea, Cecilia Clemente, together with the lab of Pat Jennings, Steve Plotkin, are the late results. So with that said, I can sort of start to play the game. And so let me start with the first transparency. So let's start light, then we start to complicate. And let's see if we can at least pose the problem. What's the problem that has been addressed for this community that we call the physics community of protein folding? And see if people can get a grasp. You've got two very nice talks, one by Ken Deal and one by Bill Witton, putting a little bit of the theoretical and experimental perspective. I'm going to try to present about some of the ideas that are similar, but try to sort of put a new perspective. So the question is, although Alex is going to tell you the reality of what a protein is, I'm going to say the idea that basically what's a protein if you try to think about in our resolution. And what's a protein, I'm not talking of the biological sense, I'm talking the way we'll be trying to work. So here is what we call the minimalist or very simple models is, do we actually have to include all the details of the proteins, or can we think about a protein as a necklace of beads with a set of simple interactions, and by understanding systems like that, can we learn something about the general features of biology? Or not only can we learn, or what can we learn, or that's just play game? Right, this has been a question that has to be addressed. The interesting thing about I had about this week, that's why I want to address different models, is because the culture of physics always say, how can we keep a model to a bare minimum, but I still can get the physics out of it, and that's what we call minimalist models. But I got people very nervous about, so don't we have to put all the details? How can you forget the explicit water molecule? So it's very funny seeing complaint of physicists on this regard. So I think we're going to try to address this problem as we come along. Okay, so there's an interesting thing about this problem when people start from the beginning, that if you look, what's the free energy of stability of a protein? How stable is a protein if you get your typical protein there? A small protein. So for all purpose, before Sophie get on my case, we're talking about small, fast-folding proteins. I may talk about larger proteins in the end. So what I'm talking about here is nice two-state proteins. We're going to get to this problem with intermediates as we go later. But initially, you see these proteins have about a stability of the free energy stability of about 10 kilocalories per mole. That's a very small number, particularly if you're a physicist, you hate kilocalories per mole, so yeah, 0.3 electron volts here makes you feel more comfortable. If you want to put this number, in practice, that's about the stabilization of a couple hydrogen bonds. Now, anybody that has done a large calculation in life, anybody, come here, you did a large calculation in life, you may ask yourself, do you believe we have any hope, if you put all the details, to do a calculation with that level of precision? And the answer is no. Imagine, here I'm putting temperature, I'm adding solvent, I put the full story. So the first answer to that is basically, if you're not good enough to do this problem, go do something else. Right? So you're not entitled to do something, you don't have any competence for that. But That's exactly the same situation that you come out to these two problems like that, is to believe there is some universal principle that are governing these things, so you have some hope. After all, people have understanding magnetism, where they have the same problems and very small energies with Ising models, and people have learned about it. So the question is there is something similar that goes to protons, and we hope there is. And if there wasn't, then all this approach would be hopeless. And I want to point one more thing. One of the reasons that we believe that's the case is because the experimental evidence supports you on that direction. Basically, proteins are very robust things, right? They can tolerate changes on the environment and stuff like that. I went out last night with Bill Whittle, we had a bottle of wine, we're still alive. Not all our proteins denature because we change the environment. If you change the pH, or if you change the temperature, or even if you do lots of mutation, this thing survives. This thing survives major changes, and the stability is still a number around that. So you know there's some robustness, intrinsic robustness about it. The next way of introducing the problem is, how do we understand folding? And the question is, what do you mean by understanding? That has been one of the major complaints. I think Bill gave a very nice introduction yesterday about what understanding means. So what I want to present here is what I call the biological viewpoint and the physical viewpoint. And I don't want to put one against the other. I will tell my belief that in the long run, our understanding of this problem is going to end up with these things being complementary. Actually, as I go through this explanation, I would like to say the biological viewpoint, where all the details and everything is important, is what I will call basically the zoological view of protein folding. And the physical viewpoint is what I'm going to call the statistical view of protein folding. And there's some questions you have to address with one, and there's some other questions you have to address with the other one. So if you get an old-liner, biological person working on folding, they're going to come to you and say, what do you mean working on protein folding? You should be working on folding of lysozyme. You should work on folding of ribonuclease. You should be working on folding of Ci2. You work on the fold of each protein. There's no such a thing as the protein folding problem. There's the folding of each protein, and each protein has its particulars intermediates. Okay, that's the one radical end of the way, and you see people going down and try to get general principles coming out of it. But most of the work done here, I want to point out, that's done with sequences that are able to fold, biological things that know they fold. There's very few work done with other things. Now, we know that not every sequence, not every heteropolymer of amino acids, if you get a random sequence of amino acids, is going to fold. And actually, people that start to do experiments this way, they do reasonable experiments. They don't get full random sequence. They do like with the right balance of hydrophobic and hydrophilic. You don't start with something very stupid like putting a sequence of 100 hydrophobic amino acids. But if you put like the right balance distribution amino acids, you notice that basically a typical sequence is not a good folder. There are very few sequences that fold. And the question is, that came from the physics community, more important to understand the folding of each protein. And I think that's the message that we got, particularly in the first talk from Ken, is what differentiates the sequence that are able to fold from the ones that are not able to fold. And they hope there are some generic features that differentiate this thing. This is not exactly what was happening here. Well, here we got sequences that you knew that they fold. You knew in advance because they are biological proteins. They're known to fold, they're known to have a structure. People go, study them, they observe their folded state. When here we say are some generic features that determine what differentiates a random sequence that we call random heteropolymer from a sequence that's able to fold. And several people here, Alice has done a lot of work on trying to look what's the general features. Basically, people here that have been working on these things have been trying to understand these general rules. So in a sense, this makes a big difference on the way people approach the problem, and both are very, very important. If in the end, we're going to have any hope of understanding the full problem, of doing design and doing stuff like that. Actually, there's several different consequences that basically, for people coming from physics, should be very natural to expect that basically, and you saw also a little bit on Ken's talk, that's the fact that basically, if there is a class of heteropolymers that's able to fold, and there's a class of properties that govern those heteropolymers, who said that the building blocks have to be amino acids? Maybe they are something else. There's not something particularly magic about nature. Nature just chooses its Lego blocks to be amino acids. But in principle, you're going to come to questions like that. And you can come up to questions of how much different kinds of blocks you need, what you need to actually build these things. So with that in mind, I think that's a major distinction that came into the folding community that people say. And I'm going to address the first question in the beginning, and then we go to look compared to experimental data. But basically, the first question that came on energy landscape theory is what characterizes that difference? And there's a lot of work by people doing on this regard. And my point of view is, although people can get on enormous and mean battles by these days, by saying, oh, but your reaction coordinate doesn't work because my reaction coordinate is better than your reaction coordinate, everybody agrees there's some reaction coordinate. So you're going to see that the main features, right? Basically, it's great that Eugene's not here to criticize my reaction coordinate, so I can actually give a talk. It's good that he's coming next week. So I'm going to have a chance to finish my talk. But we are going to see that in the end, if you go to the essence of what is behind these models, I think people are in agreement. And even if I don't have too much time today to go over what we did, we are going to try to put this message down. And you guys can come and say, yes, that's all trivial. That's probably the answer. And that's true. Everything after people have an understanding is all trivial. At least you get a meaning of what these things goes. And how this framework has given a theoretical framework that allows us not only to go and try now to see if this makes sense and try to make quantitative connections to experiments, but also try to do connections to larger simulations where you cannot investigate all details and things like that. Most of our larger simulations, as I'm going to show in the end, are going to be done for proteins that are proteins that fold. You're not going to do like a huge, one enormous computer simulation on a random heteropolymer. That will not happen. So it's right. So basically, it's very important you have this framework to tell you what you're looking when you do the simulations on and do the experiment on these very specific systems. Okay, so let me put a couple of transparency just in terms of the general features of this problem. And so the great thing about dealing with proteins is that you always can come with absurd numbers. They're very, very, very fantastic numbers to look around. So basically, if you think about that I have random sequences and you have 20 amino acids, and if you get like a protein of the order 100, all these small folding proteins, they're going to be between 50 and 200, so 100 is a good number. You're going to have enormous number of sequences. The question is, which ones are stable? And from the ones that are stable, which ones are kinetically foldable? Okay? There's a major problem with this transparency that the fact is why this is inside of this. Actually, what you need is an intersection of things that are kinetically possible and stable. But the question is, what characterizes this small system? See, the tendency of looking at sequences and try to say, can we identify? It's natural if you come from the genetic code where you have now three bases define one amino acid, you try to do the same thing for proteins. Can we identify from the sequence what the structure is? As I move along to this talk, I'm going to give you a general perspective. I will tell you that's basically not only you're going to have many sequences that may fold the same structure, but also try to point out that it's not any structure that can be designed that you want, basically. If you come here today and say, can you give me a protein? What's the sequence of protein? They give me a protein, it just looks like Mickey Mouse. You won't be able to do it. Right? So there's some particular shapes, there's some intrinsic complexity. There's some shapes it's easier to fold, it's easier to design, and Charles has done some work on that. They begin trying to figure out these things. And this is an area that is far from being formalized. I'm going to give some intuition of what you work on this way, but there is an interesting thing in trying to connect both things. An example of that, you always can have several examples, but let's just put an example out. Here is a few kinases. They have exactly the same structure and exactly the same function. They're just on different animals, basically. This one is for a pig, and these are for several different bacteria. And if you try to look at the similarity, and now you do sequence alignment here, I don't know if you heard about sequence alignment, the idea is you just try to align the sequence to see how similar they are. And you add, is a typical sequence alignment program, don't even know which one is, but with the right ways that people use for inclusions and deletions, but just try to do sequence. And what you see is you have a 15 to 20% sequence identity. Basically, this is worse than random. Actually, if you have a typical program, 25% is a good number when you align insertion deletion. So here's a case where you say, oh, you're doing worse than random. Okay. But in a sense, what I'm trying to say is there are sequences that are very, very different and can fold to same shape. And there's a question how these things go. So it's not a trivial problem that goes in. Since not everybody works on folding, I'm going to use now a few minutes to put like a 2 minutes about how these questions arise, the history of folding, and the history of landscapes. So as people heard, and we can come to a big argument, but I want to start to to point out, again, Amstein's argument. Amstein got the Nobel Prize for a very interesting piece of work. He got ribonuclease. He unfolded ribonuclease, and then he knows the ribonuclease was able to refold. So he said, oh, the protein is able to fold alone, doesn't need any help. What's so great about it is it looked to be the most complicated experiment to do. What he did is basically, if you try to do this experiment at home, and you try all the time, it doesn't work this way. Basically, you go and you fry an egg, right? You unfold the protein, and what you see is that afterwards, the egg doesn't go back to its initial shape. And the reason for that is because you're doing the experiment on a very, very high concentration of protein, so when you unfold these proteins and you cool down, these things all aggregate because you have this high concentration. So what Amstein did was he diluted. He did this experiment on high dilution, and he was able to see that if he took all these other processes, aggregation process and all these things out, the protein alone can refold. Now, you can come up with 100 questions here, and I will be glad to discuss then afterwards. Yes, but on the cell, the proteins have a larger concentration. On the cell, the protein comes out of the ribosome. On the cell, all these things, that's true. The cell has a lot of machineries to help folding. One of them is actually to prevent aggregation, because the concentration of the cell are much higher than that. But the fact we have ahead of us, and we're trying to deal, is that basically this small fast-folding proteins, and many of them, are able to fold alone without any outside help. Clearly, that's also important for the biological process, but it's an interesting problem on itself, and that's the problem we're going to try to address here. Right? Many of these proteins, people argue, oh, but there's some memory that came before. No. Some of these proteins, even if you synthesize them on solid-state synthesis without ever seeing a DNA or RNA in life, they're able to fold on that shape if you put the right sequence on physiological conditions. So Leventhal in 1968 had a problem. Well, Leventhal said, oh, that's an interesting problem to address. And he knew what he was talking about, but somehow he died on the process. So people got confused about what he said, and they create a paradox. One never meant to create a paradox. Okay? So what Leventhal said in 1968 was the following. Let's imagine here. I have a sequence of amino acids, and it said, how many structures are available for this one? So here's my first amino acid, and I'm going to put my second one. And let's assume my second one has two possible orientations. Actually, if you come from old polymer physics, and Ken probably has seen these numbers too much in his life, the numbers are more or less around 5, if you include just the main chain, and of the order of 8 and 10 if you want to use the side group. But let's just use 2. Any number you use here. It's bad, but it's 2. So expect now if you have 100 amino acids, you're going to have about 2 to 100 states. You can reduce these states by saying they are collapsed and stuff like that, but still, you always end up with large numbers. So the question he said, okay, 2 to 100 is about 10 to 30, and this number can get worse. And let's assume I could probe every state on the fastest possible time I can imagine, because you cannot do that faster than a picosecond. Would take 10 to the 18 seconds to fold. So these are many different versions that come from Leventhal paradox. Anybody presents with its own perspective, but they all end up with numbers based 10 to the 3rd, 10 to the 18, depends on how generous you are to all these numbers. But the bottom line is, you end up with numbers that small. Okay, first of all, we know there's no paradox, but there are problems much more complicated than that they can do. For example, crystallization is a problem 10 times more much more complicated than that, in the sense that crystallization, you may have a certain number of congregation per molecule, but then you have an Avogadro number of the molecule. So you can see any number to the power of the Avogadro number is a very large number. Right? So, and we still believe that crystallization happens. So there are other problems where the search problem is important. The question here is, there's no paradox here because what you're searching here, that's the case where you would have absolute no bias or no indication, no hint on the process telling you which state you're going for. And if that's the case, then you get to these numbers. But as you put bias, right? So the example people like to say is that this is a problem where you have it's the golf course problem, right? It's the blind person on the flat golf course. If folding or something like that, then it would have this enormous number, but that's not the case. So the idea of the fun I'm going to present it as we come along, I'm going to do now, but is basically how do you have some energy drive, some bias to compensate for that entropy loss. I'll talk a little bit about entropy as I come along, and I will do a little bit as I come beyond, basically, what we're calling entropy here from now on. And I'll address that point, because there has been a point, enormous contention out there, is what we call configurational entropy. is the entropy of the chain, and the side loop is this configuration entropy. There's a big number that comes from the solvation, right? That's the hydrophobic effect, and that's entropy with a different sign. And they actually almost cancel each other. Some people say, oh, the total loss of entropy in folding is a very large number. Actually, if you do the experiment, it's almost zero, because the hydrophobic effect has a big entropic component. And I will address that in a little bit. But so as we talk entropy here, let's think about this being configuration entropy. And most of the solvent gets addressed into the effect potentials we have in our models. If you have an HP potential I can present, that's the PP interaction. And actually, if I have time, I will address the problem of solvation a little bit more in details in the end, or at least give you a hint of what people are doing, trying to address, because actually trying to have a quantitative representation of the hydrophobic effect is a very important problem. So with that in mind, is when the first work came, is the work that base of many people come, is can you do simple models, and can you come with general principles? And the general principle we'll talk about is the principle that people already talked about, the principle of minimal frustration that's going to be responsible for the funnel. So what's the principle of minimal frustration? Principle of minimal frustration can be thought about, let's assume I have a run of heteropolymer here. And if it's a heteropolymer, I have to have at least two kinds of residues. So let's assume basically we have red and blue like I have here. And let's assume I can put the simplest possible potential between these residues. So just to make an example, if you have some general features, so I'm going to say that you have two kinds of residues, and I say red likes red, blue likes blue, and red hates blue. So I have a random sequence of red and blue beads, and I have this very simplified potential. And I'm doing simulation that tells you how the landscape of these things look like. And what you see is you end up with a system where you have a bunch of low energy states. And these low energy states are structurally very different. And that's because they're frustrated minimum. Actually, you can do that experiment, right? I apologize for the people that already heard this story before, but I think it's a very good representation. I always like to say my wife teaches elementary school. And if when you go to elementary school, you have a classroom where you have half boys and half girls, and you're first grade or second grade, you know what happens. At that age, boys like boys and girls like girls, and boys hate girls. There's a first order phase transition late in your life. But at that age, that's what happens, okay? So now you are as the teacher, and you use your overwhelming power as the teacher, and you put these two kids in a random order. See, give hands. Now you create the polymer. That's the power of the teacher. Right, so you have this line of kids giving hands, boys and girls, some random fashion. And now you tell them, get close to a friend. Every boy tries to get close to a boy. Every girl tries to get close to a girl. But if you have a random sequence, you're going to end up with a couple of slow ones that they never come together. You have a boy next to a girl, and that's exactly a frustrated interaction. There's a frustration on that interaction. Right? That's exactly what frustration means. There's not people like to put spins up. No. It's a very simple. Okay? So what happens is, if you repeat this experiment many, many times, you're going to end up having these low energy states. But what happens is, each of these low energy states, when you have a few interactions, they're not satisfied. And which interaction are not satisfied, they may vary from each time you run the experiment. And that's the reason why you end up having these low energy states that are structurally different. Each one of them satisfy different random interactions. Okay, that's exactly what you don't want if you want to do the folding problem. This is a system, right? We have a random sequence, absolutely no bias. You don't know which of these minima is the one you want. And actually, not only that, basically, you may have a minimum that by chance is a little bit lower than the other one, but that's a fairly non-robust problem. In a sense, you do some minor variations on the potentials, and now what the minima is change the other one. So not only this problem is very difficult to search what's the absolute lowest minimum, even if you could find it, would be absolutely irrelevant because it's fairly non-robust. And you know proteins are very robust. So the concept that we're trying to introduce the funnel that become the base of energy landscape, not that you just fold faster because you need a fast folder, that's just more like you fold faster because by the time you make robust and good folders, fast folding comes almost as a consequence, but these things come all together. It's a package that you need. So how are you going to do that? You're going to do that, basically, you're going to try to bring one of these states and pull it down relative to everything else. So say, how do I design one of these states relative to everything else? And that creates an idea that has been out by many, many people. It's still on design that based the so-called energy gap. You have to create a gap of energy between these low energy states, the one you design. And you have to have energy gap that's big, that's large. I still remember my days in graduate school that if I learned one thing from John Hopfield, he told me, remember, if you talk about energy gap, energy has to have dimensions. So you cannot say it's big, it's large. You have to say large compared to what? Right? Something with dimensions, right? So the question is, large compared to what? And the large compared to what, I won't go into details of all the theory, is that basically you want to bring a state down so that the state is stable at a temperature high enough that you don't get trapped on these local minimas at that temperature. So there's an intrinsic temperature that comes from the roughness of the landscape that basically you get trapped on these minimums for a long time, and you want to make sure that this is deep enough that you're stable before you do that. So there's a range of temperatures that this happens. And the numbers people were talking about, the salt talks, basically real proteins, you'll see that basically their TF is a number of the order of 330 Kelvin, 340 Kelvin, and most of these glass temperatures, when people do this experiment, about 170. So they have about this ratio, what you have about the ratio of order 2 or 1.8, depending on how you do these things. Right? But there's a window where you can actually fold those proteins. That's the principle of minimal frustration. The question is, how do you realize minimal frustration? And we came to the idea, what we call a protein folding funnel. So I'm going to try to introduce this sort of very ideal idea of the funnel to be able to achieve this concept of minimal frustration.
So the
okay, there are several different, basically, experimentally on the folding problem is basically impossible, right? When you're just doing folding experiments. The way people have seen is these experiments that Hans Frauenfelder has done or Petzkus has done, where they have been looking most of the proteins around the folded state, and they start to see this glass behavior. But nobody has actually seen a glass behavior for a fully unfolded state that you'll be happy to do it. And nobody has actually seen what you're going to show on systems experimentally, a situation where you see going from this exponential to this sort of non-exponential behavior experimentally. And the reason is proteins actually, in practice, right, because of hydrophobic effect and codenaturation, the sequence that fold, you're actually unable to do experiments all the way down there. So that's much more something that you work as a working principle, and you try to figure out the typical roughness of the landscape. If the situation that you see at room temperature could be extend down to the lower temperature, but that's a good point. So I'm trying to say the 170 is actually not a fair number to compare, although it's a good number, because people are actually looking at motions of the protein or red fluctuation around the folded state.
Yeah, there's another tremendous technical problem in trying to measure glass temperature for a protein is that the dynamics are highly influenced, obviously, by the solvent, and a lot of the transitions that people previously thought were glass transitions of protein really turned out to be just the glass transition of the solvent dominating the internal dynamics of the protein.
So, by the way, there's a tremendous amount of work on comparing analytical models with simulations here. I'm going sort of cavalier, ignore all that during my talk. And he probably can talk some other time, some other people, because otherwise that becomes a talk on itself, basically. And right now I have my group, Steve Plotkin, used to be a graduate student with Peter Wall. We are doing a lot of work when you add correlation on the landscape, basically. The simplest TG came by people comparing the roughness of the landscape, apply a random energy model to it, and try to get a number out of it. So that was like a very simplified view. But as you start to complicate the model and the correlation to the landscape, there's an entire industry of trying to figure out which level of analytical models can we create that actually incorporate enough to represent the simulations. So we skip a little bit over these things, but it's important to keep that in mind and to know that. So what I'm going to present... Yes? I will tell you what we mean from simulations. If you give me a little bit, if you give me 10 minutes, then I come back to the analytical definition. Yes?
Probably first want to tell people TF doesn't mean freezing temperature.
No, folding temperature, I'm sorry. That's the folding temperature.
Yes.
Yeah, folding temperature. Yeah. If you give me 5 or 10 minutes, I'll present a number, and then we address exactly the point you're trying to raise. But I just want to show some data from simulation, and then we address exactly the point you're trying to raise. So before I present these very simplified simulations, I want to tell you the basic idea that came out on the folding concept to try to create this bias. So basically, here is the overall general idea, and I can tell you where all the discussion and things come. Let's imagine I could enumerate I have a particular heteropolymer, and let's imagine I could enumerate every single possible configuration of this heteropolymer. Right? If you're doing two dimensional like Ken did, you can actually do that. You can actually enumerate all of them. If you go to three dimensional, you have technical problems. If you have a problem that's not on the lattice, then you have to create a resolution. What do you mean to be a state? But let's assume that in principle, under a determined resolution, I can enumerate every state. Now I'm going to assume that there are some reaction coordinates or order parameters or something that we agree they're going to use as something that we're going to measure similarity. And I hope in the end that this order parameter that measures similarity is also a good measure as a kinetic variable. Okay? It may not be one. There's a big argument. You need one or two. If I have time, I can show you that basically sometimes you need a couple of them. Q is the one we have been using for a long time because a very natural one to do is like if you have a protein or any structure, you have what you call your tertiary contacts. They're the contacts which residues are in contact on the folded structure. And you count how many contacts you have, tertiary contacts, to have an idea. If you have a protein with about 60 amino acids, you have about 30 of those. If you go to about 100 amino acids, you have about 50 or 60 of those tertiary contacts. And you say, you measure similarity by say every configuration that I get for the protein, how many of the native contacts are there? If the total number of contacts is 100, I have 50, is 60, and I have 30, I say that's Q is equal to 0.5. So I'm using this sort of global parameter as measure similarity. Yes, Dave?
Just to make sure I understand, in order to get around the experimental
Okay. So now let's assume how do I get this? What I'm trying to say, how we do by design if I could this thing. So now I have all these configurations and I order them by similarity. So you see that base here is the one that's my native state. Then I say I have a few that are very similar, have a few more that are more different, and keep going up, 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 up as I do here. Now, what's the ideal potential that I would have here? There are two problems in order to come from a random state. A typical state started random to come down here. One of them is energetically, what I would like is if I can create an energy, if I can create some potential, if I design a sequence, that the order, the similarity and energy almost to be in the same axis. So let's imagine I have this capability. This is what people are calling goal models, or the models that by hand you put this design, right? That the energy is exactly correlated to similarity. The question is, when you design, it's very hard to achieve. But in principle, that's what you want to do. If you're able to do that, then what you see is the native states, the lowest energy states, the ones a little bit more different, are just a little bit in energy. So not all these things are ordered in similarity, they are also ordered in energy. There's an extra problem that comes from the fact you have a heteropolymer. And it's the fact that basically, how do I guarantee that states that are close, similarly closed, at least on this order parameter, they're actually kinetically closed. Because you may have things that basically, particularly the heteropolymer, chains cannot cross each other. So depending on the shape, things may have trouble to fold. Based on the order of formation of contacts may depend. And there are structures where the order of formation of contacts is almost irrelevant. There are structures where this order becomes very important, and that creates intrinsically complication. And that's what people are using and misusing the word, including me, the word topology. And the reason they don't call it just geometrical is because just not the shape of the protein determines there. Because since you have a heteropolymer, it's not something just depends on the shape, but also depends on where the cut, where the beginning and the end of the sequence is. So things can fold the same shape, but the beginning of the end of the sequence may depend on how you fold that particular shape. And for that reason, people use this word to say there's some shapes, the most symmetric ones that you have many ways to go in, the other ones are more complicated. So these two things, the fact that, yes?
Leaving out a kinetic issue for now, how would I know that a heteropolymer, a protein, you can arrange a protein to have the energy axis and the Q axis on top of each other?
Okay, that is the ideal design. People can actually design reasonably well. In real life, you don't do that. That's why in real life, although you may have a big bias in energy, you have intrinsic roughness. I just represent by delta E, and I scrambled these states a little bit to show you that in real life you don't have it.
If I had done any simulation,
what?
What is real life?
Oh, experiment, real simulation. The point I'm going to try to make is that a typical protein, a typical biological protein, has actually a fairly smooth landscape. And I'm going to try to compare the experiment as I come about it. So, and I will tell you, if I can just...
Let me ask you a minute.
Sure.
What aspect of the amino acid interaction would guarantee me that if I work hard enough, I will find this thing?
Okay. I will try to pose your question In the opposite way, as I come about on the next situation. That's the following thing. What I'm going to try to say is that as long as you are able to design with a sufficiently smooth landscape, then the description in terms of few order parameters is a good one. If you are unable to do that, then the description completely becomes irrelevant, and you are controlled by traps, and these general features of trying to reduce the problem into a few reaction coordinates become totally invalid. So let me try to address. So with this is just the idea. And that's the idea of the funnel. And I'm not telling you that's the reality, but that's what we introduced. They said landscapes like that are good folders. They have some energetic roughness, and they have what we call topological roughness. Basically, and that's one thing people are not taking into account, and it's a very important point that people are starting to address these things. That basically is not only to design a good sequence to fold a particular shape, but different shapes may be easier to design than others. So that may limit on the kind of shapes that proteins can fold to, right? So you have to keep the, when you do a design, and I tell you I want to design exactly to this shape, I'm constraining myself. So you have to keep the two things into consideration. So let's keep these two things in mind. Okay, if you believe this entire thing is true, then I can write my problem. And that's the case I'm going to try to make, the point of contention, but that's the point people have been using on the biochem description. I can write the free energy as a function of this Q, or whatever the appropriate reaction coordinate. And if you have one reaction coordinate or a few, it's not the problem. As we make the systems more complex, we have to get one reaction coordinate, keep track of the secondary structure, one that keeps track of collapse, but still a handful of these coordinates. And then you have the figures that you saw a lot of them on the last 2 days. There are free energy profiles that look like that, right? And as basically, you have this free energy that basically, if you're above TF, the unfolded minimum is dominate. If you have below TF, the fold temperature, the fold minimum is dominate. And we hope we can describe our, and if you're above TG, then I will address the question since I promised to come back to that issue. We hope that we can explain these things at least to a good level as diffusion on this lower dimensional free energy profile. And why that's important?
Again, you really mean that TN is not GB transparency, or?
What?
You really mean that TN is different from a TG?
Yes. Okay. They have to be, otherwise these things don't work. That's the point I'm going to try to make as I come about. That's what I'm going to try to come. So, what I want to point out here is that this thing becomes very important, because if I can describe this thing as diffusion on this reaction coordinate, then I can say that the rate is determined by overcoming this barrier. And if I identify the ensemble of states in the top of this barrier, I can identify what my transition state of the problem is without doing the full kinetics of the problem. And why that becomes important, because you're going to try to see that on small models, simplified models, I can actually do the full kinetics, I can study everything. But as I start to go to more and more detailed simulation, O-atom simulations, people are unable to do the full kinetics, so they represent the data in terms of these free energy profiles as a function of free reaction coordinates, and we hope that the information we're getting from there from these detailed simulations have some meaning, and we use this approach. Before telling you real systems, let me tell you a couple things. The most studied system, and probably you're going to hear, has been these lattice models. They have the two-dimensional lattice model, but there is these three-dimensional lattice models. And lots of people here work on these models where you have two kinds of beads, and you say the interaction between these beads, like blue beads, red beads, like red beads. And this 27 became very famous because there is 103,000 different ways that you can fold a 27 into these shapes. And the question now is, can you design sequence the fold to that particular shape? Now, let me tell you a couple of things. I was not going to show that because I was going to skip this thing, but let me show some things so that we don't get in trouble. So if I have a two-letter code for these systems and I run these simulations, if I have a well-designed sequence, let me just get this from here. If I have a very nice well-designed sequence, if I use just a two-letter code, the best I can do on a two-letter code, when I have the parameters now adjust, typical good parameters, I won't go on details of this model because otherwise you're not going to see anything. What you see is, if you measure the folding time as being the time that takes for this thing to start from an unfolded state and the mean first passage time to find the native state. I'm not even worried if this is stable. Here I'm talking about the kinetics, how long it takes at different temperatures for this thing to find the folded state. What we learn when we do that is that basically here is a good folding sequence. You see at a high temperature, this thing takes a long time to fold because it doesn't collapse. And this state is a collapsed state. As you come down in temperature, you see you hit this plateau, right, that you fold. And then for my choice of parameters, around the temperature of order one, you see, bing, skyrocket. These times just go up by a long time. So in our definition kinetic here, we chose to define Tg as being the temperature that these things slow down by a factor about 100 from the fastest folding time. And then we get a number of order one. If you prefer 1,000, it's going to be 0.95. It's a finite system. So it's a time where you get a substantially slow down. So I'm giving you a class. That's our kinetic description of Tg on these things. Something these things get awfully slow when you do these things.
On the move set.
Oh, yes. I'm not going on the details of the simulation. That's why I say these models just give you a qualitative view of the problem, and you shouldn't take beyond that because, like I said, this thing depends on choice of move set, depend on all things. I'm avoiding to go.
So there are a lot of
pictures
because in the picture you had before that I misunderstand it. The glass temperature size.
No, this case is not. So I'm telling you a typical well-designed sequence, and you see this kind of behavior. Let me just get one transparency that I want to. I'll get there. Just one second. I missed one transparency here. I want to show. I don't know where this went. Just give me one second. Okay. It's here. The time dependence of these things at low temperature, like I said, what we learn from our experience is basically when we try to plot these things like versus 1 over t squared, we get an equally good fit. Basically, on these models, I don't want to even get into this discussion. What I'm trying to say is that the numbers that you get for delta E, they are more reasonable when you fit with when you fit with t square and you look at the delta E that you get, the difference of energy of these states, you get a number that's more reasonable on the fit on 1 over t square than you get on the fit of 1 over t. But besides that, I don't know.
Well, the problem is that you're doing fit fiber complicated because you need one more temperature of what's happening, and maybe you just don't need that.
No, no. Here, what do you mean by that? No, here is just I have. What I'm trying to avoid is to spend 1 hour doing this ladder simulation. If you want, I can go over and give all the details of the simulation. The point I'm trying to make here is the following thing. If you get many of these sequences, I'm going to put the results, and people don't like, I'll be glad to go to details, because this gets very boring if you start to show 7 years old ladder simulation. What I get is the following thing, is that when we use a two-letter code into the system to design these things, the best TF we're able to get is about 1.3. And that gets a TG, with my definition of TG that I show you, of about 1.
That's the simulation of 27 peaks, you don't have any phase transition.
So that's correct. But so the proteins don't have phase transition either, in a sense. They're all finite systems. That's why I was very careful on my definition of TG. And that's why there's a lot of work of people trying to basically. So when people relate, and that's a very good point, because proteins have a big surface. So when people relate on the development of these theories, they use like the random energy model, and they say the base TG is like the roughness divided by the square root of the entropy. That's as far as you want to do these relationships. You don't want to really push and try to give a deeper meaning for that. So you I think there's a lot of very serious work being done on that, but you're correct. That's why I'm not saying you have a transition. And more than anything else, when you look at these experiments, you cannot differentiate. Actually, proteins are far from their thermodynamic limit. Actually, a typical protein has the right order of the ratio of surface to volume area. It's what makes a protein to fold. So there's a lot, I agree with you, there's a lot of questions here. But with my definition, I say that basically, that I have, when you look at the substantial slowdown, and I'm going to go over this definition a little bit more. On the early work we did with Nick Soch, we used that definition. And what we see here is that the maximum you can do designing a sequence is like, if I use a three-letter code, this ratio is about 1.3. And if you use like a two-letter code, this ratio is about 1.6. And these numbers become more the kind of roughness that you have been observing on proteins. But these things are too rough for our fast folders. So this is just in a case to tell you, in terms of design, how far can you go. And I'm going to show you some examples in more detail. Why going from a two-letter code to three-letter code becomes important? There's an important thing as you do design. And that's the message I want to point here. Let's imagine, I'm doing everything in three dimensions, but let's look in two dimensions. These are two ground states, designed by a two-letter code and designed by a three-letter code. If you look then, all the contacts are satisfied here. Blue Swiss blues and red Swiss red. It's a perfectly unfrustrated ground state. Why is this one better than this one? This one is better because when you look at your unfolded states, for example, you can have, like for example, in this case, you can have a non-native contact where you have this, can have this blue coming together with this blue and make a strong contact on a trap. Here, you're not going to make. It's going to be a weak one because now you have blue and green. So when you're getting a funnel and getting a design of a sequence, you're not only designing your ground state, but you're undesigning traps. So as you come along on this entire thing, these two things become very, very important. Not only design the state you're coming to, but you're undesigning the traps. And actually, if you want to see how far we can imagine, on the early work with Nick, what we did is say, let's get our well-designed sequence, the one that's 1.6. And at least for this system, let's do the full time evolution of the system. That becomes a long simulation, I can tell you, because you want to do the full time evolution, you have to do enough runs. It's different just measuring average mean first passage time. So what we did is, we are looking at folding runs at different temperatures. You start from TF and going down all the way to TG to my well-designed sequence. Okay.
Is it possible to measure the folding time in the experiment?
Yes.
Versus temperature?
Yes.
But how important is that?
Okay. Basically, I can tell you a little bit, but you're going to have experts telling you about how they actually measure this thing by the chevron plots and relaxation process. Normally, what people measure in experiments, I don't know, Bill showed you and can show you several of the chevron plots when you show the relaxation time. And if you assume you have a two-level system, you can show these relaxation times at both folding and unfolding. So you can actually extract both the folding rate and the unfolding rate for those experiments.
Yes.
But you need a spectroscopy probe. If you have some spectroscopy probe, can be a tryptophan, can be CD, can be some probe you have experimentally.
Yeah, that question is reasonable. So for good protein, it's typically over 2G.
Okay. Well, if you put typical numbers, that's right, that's what we did. When we put typical numbers in our landscape, and that we put the time when the scenes get rough, and we look at NMR data, what's the time they take to move between traps, we got numbers of the order between 1.8 and 2.2. These are the numbers we get. And several other people have been playing the same exercise, playing their numbers. Bill have played, a lot of people have played, put these numbers in there. And that's more or less what you expect a protein to be in typical numbers in terms of this roughness to do it. Oh, people don't actually measure TG. That's a very good point. What they use is, you use the idea that TG is proportional to this roughness, delta E square, and you put this number in there and try to relate that the typical roughness of the landscape to these numbers. But that's the level that you can do these things. I don't want to go beyond that.
Blake here, at the end of the row here, has tried to measure TG for protein L kinetically, and just sees that it's something below 240 Kelvin, as well as we can go by experiment.
Okay, I'm glad you said these numbers. If I go from what I said in the beginning, people have been seeing out of this number that you observe from Hans Frauenfelder and Petzko experiments, the number of 170, 180, 190. But I don't want to push this into what, like I said, those experiments, you're looking at fluctuations around the folded state. So the idea to extrapolate that number to the full unfolded protein is really stretching.
Yeah, that's sort of like the actual folding, which unfortunately we can't
do. So anyway, when you put these numbers together on these simple models, on these very simplified models, And you do this plot here, and you do this plot here. Here is a plot for that sequence, this three-letter code well designed. What we do here is a probability of folding. You start from unfolded state, so this is the density of unfolding, see how much these things fold versus time, but it's a log plot, so it's a log plot. The lines here are not fits. The lines are exponential on the mean first passage time at different temperatures. So what you're looking by that is how exponential this process is. So what you're clearly seeing is at temperatures around TF, these are very nice exponential. And at temperatures when you get off the order of TG, these things really start to be a really real power loss. And if you look at the numbers, you see that basically at temperature 1.509 is TF, these are very nice exponential. And that agrees with the diffusion picture I told you before. We are going to show these results before, but you can talk about this being diffusion over the barrier and things are well defined. 1.26, we still have this exponential description working. At 1.12, you're getting close to TG. You see, this is a finite system. It's not a sharp transition. You start to see deviation. And as you get this thing, you become totally power law. So here, really, the kinetics is defined a funnel-like landscape, what you can describe in terms of overcoming the barrier of a free energy profile. And here, your kinetics is completely controlled by traps when you are the RTG. And the reason you get power law, this is controlled by the times to escape from each particular trap. Yes, Dave?
So if you have one of these multiple point sequences, is there a way analytically and numerically to see sort of how the number of paths from the fully unfolded state to the fully folded state
Okay. We are start to count paths now. I'm going to show how people count experimentally on the next one, actually what they actually do to look at this transition state. Okay, so with this in mind, and let me tell you a story. These things we have been seeing, this kind of behavior, we have been seeing not only for lattice models, but just to present here are systems where you have off-lattice models with secondary structure and the full simulation, and you get similar behavior. I don't want to go in details here because otherwise I will get off lattice model, but you can see here, particular, this thing going from a well-designed system being completely exponential, and as you start to run random, you go from exponential to a full power law. So similar behaviors have been observed. So with this in mind, that's what is behind the general idea of the energy landscape. And now, that's what I say, they came from these very simplified lattice models that give these general ideas. And I agree that the general work we have to do now, and I hope to address as much as I can in the rest of the time, is how you can relate these things to the real experiments. So let me put a little bit on, try to relate these things to more complicated models. Okay. So what I'm trying to convince you is, as long as we are above the glass temperature, I can describe my model as being Here is a real free energy profile. Forget about this one. The lines, just look at the solid line here. Here's the free energy profile for that well-designed 27er. Okay, so this comes from the simulation. You do all the sampling, and you write your free energy profile as a function of that Q. You have 28 contacts on the native state, so you see the Q varies between 0 and 28. This bump here doesn't count because the transitions are direct, so that's an artificiality that you never form that state. So forget it. So what you see is you have a minimum here, you overcome this barrier, and you come towards a folded state on 28. What we have been trying to make the case is to show you that as long as you are above the glass temperature, I can describe my kinetics as being a diffusive process over this barrier.
What do you mean by free energy here? So you keep the number of Qs and you sum all along?
That's right, yes.
And you average over the different?
That's right. So I complete the free energy profile with the constraint of Q being fixed.
So let's say Q equal to 8. That means you pick any 8 of the
next. That's right. And with the free energy with that constraint. We don't enumerate all the configurations, but actually we have enough sampling to do this thing quite well. Nick worked very hard on doing the multi-histogram on this thing, so we have no problem on believing every single number here.
So this is the HB model? Or the model?
No, this is just the model I said, the AB model.
AB
model. And that's for the nice three-letter code. It's ABC, actually, three-letter code, because we don't want something too rough. The other one is very rough. So I have the 27, so I want to tell you that basically we hope to believe that you can describe this model as diffusion on this thing. And as long as you have a funnel-like landscape, this should work okay.
And all of the configuration are from the compact?
What?
Some of the configuration, they're all compact structures?
No, they're all configurations. All configurations. Now, what Nick did, and that same thing can be questioned, but I want to present here in a very nice way, is the following thing. We saw the things, but what we did to try to fit a model into this thing here was the following idea. Let's imagine, can we talk about it? That's a Crummer process? You can describe that as just being Crummers and diffusion on this situation. What he did is like, he said, what we have to do is to overcome this barrier around here. That's about 60% of the contacts. So what he did is, he measured relaxation times around this minimum. In most of the cases, these were times much shorter than the folding time. So by measuring relaxation times around this minimum here, he could come up and get effective diffusion coefficient. So he tried. So he measured sort of QQ relaxation, right? From the correlation between QQ correlation here, you got a diffusion coefficient in Q from this thing here. So what Nick did on the early work was actually to show that actually, by measuring the diffusion coefficient and fitting on that free energy profile, use the Crummers. Here's a Crummers formula. He actually can represent all the Monte Carlo results quite well.
You assume it's the diffusion coefficient is constant for all Q.
Yes, and that's a very That's a very good. The point he asked, it's a very, very good point, and I'm addressed because he really raised the issue. I tried to sneak through it, but he didn't let me. Is the following say basically, why don't you expect this diffusion coefficient to vary with Q? Actually, you'd expect as Q gets much larger, that this diffusion coefficient gets lower. Actually, on this particular potential, we have the diffusion coefficient actually doesn't depend on Q that much, depends on the degree of collapse, depends on how collapsed you are. Since on this particular potential, we have pre-collapse, and actually states that you have to overcome are around here, they don't change that much. But in general, if you had a real model, if you have a model where collapse and folding happens together, you'd have to address the point you're trying to raise quite well. So at least doing that, by doing this picture, what I have shown you is that basically we can agree, we can get it. There are some questions here. People argue about it because basically, while you're on the limit of high enough temperature, then you have a big barrier. When you get to very low temperature, then the barrier becomes small, so you may question the model, say that the correlation time is almost the entire diffusion thing. But the reason is, even on the high temperature regime here, where you have barriers up to 7 or 8 kT, you see the result does quite well. You may wonder about the results here, since the folding time relaxation are about the same. But these things here, you have substantial barrier, and you can show that you can represent this model in terms of diffusion. Okay, with that in mind, I'm almost ready to get to proteins. It's what we create this picture that has been out there for a long time, what we call our funnel picture. Right? So this picture is just a cartoon that put out this idea to say that a fast folding protein has a TF over TG of about 1.6 to 2, has a transition state for this particular 27, it's a protein about 60 amino acids, about 60%, but can be a little bit more, a little bit less as these proteins change. And you see the process is like you collapse into a state, the unfolded state, you overcome this transition state, and you come to native structure. The question is, can we probe how this transition state looks like? And a lot of the stuff we have been seeing is, what we'd love to, based on what Bill Eaton told you yesterday, is to actually see all these states, how all these paths looks like, right? So this single molecule, because the entire evolved secondary structure being formed, we love to actually see and to address the questions like Liefeld has asked a little bit, all these details, and try to put a structure here, right? But the question, we can't do that. We can't do that. So since we can't do that, what we are left with is what people can do in experiment is to figure out what's the nature of this transition state. And here, before I show you numbers, because now I'm going to show numbers, start from simple models and going to complicated models, I want to point out one thing. If I had a funnel where my energy was perfect and I had no topological problems, then the order of contacts, which order they are formed, is not important. So the fact that I said you that Q is equal to 0.6 would be equivalent to say that if I look at the ensemble of all the states around this transition state, every contact should exist there with a probability of 60%. So it should be a completely, but now you can say, okay, it's not true because the energies are not perfect, so you're going to have now a temperature spread, the lower energy states and the higher energy state may be different, so you have an energetic factor, or you may have a topological factor, depending on shape, some contacts have to be formed before the other contacts. So the real question is, we know this thing is not, you don't have every contact participating with equal probability, so you cannot see all paths, but you can see how much each contact participates there. The fact that you see with the five values that you heard yesterday, difference, does this difference come from energetic difference, or did difference come from topological difference? Are the proteins well designed? What's the term this thing? And before I show you experimental numbers, we have to sort of feel comfortable with the model we are using, because how you determine these phis? These phis experimentally actually are not determined by measuring free energy profiles. After all, when Sophie goes to the laboratory, she doesn't see a free energy profile with a nice barrier, she should go and look at the barrier. The way it's done on the experiments, actually on this phi analysis, what people measure is actually K wild type is the folding rate of the protein on the original state. Then you do a mutation, right? You go and change one amino acid that's going to affect several contacts. So what you measure is the difference of the ratio between these free energy profiles. Of difference of these rates over the total difference in stability. Okay? So what you are doing here, just to remember, is they measure the difference in stability. If I look into this picture, if you make this state less stable, you're bringing this up. So delta delta G naught is by how much you change the stability, the difference between these states, right? You're changed by how much you're changing stability. And you measure the ratio of the rates. Now, if you believe that our diffusion picture is correct, if you buy into that diffusion picture, if you buy that you can relate those free energy profiles to kinetics, then I can say that my rate is a prefactor that depends on my diffusion coefficient on that particular temperature, as I show you, times something that depends on the barrier. And if I do a mutation, I can relate the ratio of the rates to the difference in the top of the barrier. And in simulation, that's very easy to compute because they don't have to do all the dynamics. That's what people are doing when they do all atom simulations. They cannot do all the dynamics. But notice that this imposes the fact that this, say, most of the change when you do a mutation comes on the barrier of my free energy profile. That's really the dominant factor and not on this prefactor. If that's not true, then the typical interpretation that we do when we just look on these free energy profiles to get phi, they say phi is how much to change the barrier, like Bill Eaton explained yesterday, over the stability is not going to be valid. So there's a self-consistency here that you have to live with, that Because the fact that basically, if you have to have a reasonably smooth landscape, otherwise you're not going to be able to reduce to a few reactions. Maybe not the one I like it, but just that if you're controlled by traps, if traps start to control, then it's K-naught is the dominant factor. That's when they start to get the non-exponential behavior. What we did here, we got three sequences. That's still the 27. I just want to show this result here. And what we did, we measure all these five values for all our 28 contacts, right? By destroying each contact and measure the five values for three different sequences. Same shape, but we designed the same shape with three different potentials. Two of them I already told you is our best two-letter code and our best three-letter code. They go exactly the same shape, but it's the best sequence designed to it. And the other one is what we call the goal model. We took all the roughness by hand. We said only native contacts are attractive. Everything else doesn't count. And when you do that, you can see that base for the goal model, there's a very good correlation between the phi measured using kinetics and the phi measured using this relationship. This is what this line is showing you here. This is the kinetics, is the phi measure using the relationship above, and what I call phi thermodynamics is the phi measure just looking at the barrier, not doing the full kinetics. So what you see here is actually that you have a spread of phis. The real phi should be around 0.4, and the reason is because it's actually the probability of being on the transition state minus the probability of being on unfolded. But you see they're not all 0.4. You have a spread of them. What tells you the topology is important, because this case has no energetic frustration. It has been by hand I took all the energetic frustration and tell you that some contacts can be formed before the other one. When you go to our three-letter code, you see that basically the correlation is not that great. We go for a correlation for 0.91 to a correlation about 0.7. You see a lot of much more spread. So you see there's some trapping to the process. The fact you're using the free energy profile has some problem, but you still have a very good correlation. But if you look contact by contact, they're about the same. So you see this thing is still well designed enough, and most of the heterogeneity of contact probability on the transition state is determined by what? By topology. So this is still determined being a well-designed sequence, and you're seeing that three-letter code is still reasonable. Like I said, 1.6 is reasonable. 1.3, you see here, there's no correlation. There's enough trapping in our system that try to describe your phi in terms of these things means absolutely nothing, right? You can basically see, other than say we fill up the box, there's no correlation whatsoever. So you see that our picture, our description in terms of this kinetic view, the funnel picture, start to fail on the two-letter code. We are too rough. So we believe the proteins are here. Proteins are much smoother. They are living on this regime, and that's why we have all these correlations with phi, and the experiments are saving us. Okay? So let me show you a little bit of these results. For real proteins. So now what I'm going to try to do is to show a little bit of a first connection to experiments. And I know I'm running, but I will continue a little bit more just so that we can relate these things. So what we did first is like I had a very nice postdoc, basically. I have two very nice postdocs recently after Nick. One is Steve Plotkin and Cecilia Clement in the lab. Cecilia has running all the simulations, going to tell you, and Plotkin is doing a lot of analytical theories. I don't have time to tell you today just because it would take a long time to talk about free energy functionals. But let me tell you about the simulations because they are nice. What we did is, let's cheat completely. If you are so correct and we believe on this picture, if you really have faith, so I'm going to do the following game. I'm going to do a model of a protein. And I'm going to assume that my protein is perfectly designed. And the reason I believe my design is because I'm going to put by hand a goal potential. That's a perfect design for that shape into the protein. And then I'm going to measure my phi values and I'm going to compare to experiments. And the question is, if we believe the proteins are really well designed, they are on the regime that I told you, like you saw, this three-letter code over above, these phis, although we are not having a perfect potential, although they should be very similar. As I showed you on our lattice model, we believe as long as you are on well-designed sequence, the difference in phis can move from the topological parts of the protein, and you should be able to see results. If our model is completely wrong, then we should fail totally on this experiment that we are doing. So I'm going to show you two kinds of simulations, but let me show you a little bit of these simulations. We represent the protein here. Now, we are not doing lattice anymore, right? So we have to do something. So the simplified model for protein is what we call a C-alpha model. We just represent the protein by one bead per amino acid. We have two kinds of potentials to be put on this protein, basically. One of them is, these two terms here don't have to worry about. That's just to fix the geometry of the chain. The other two are important. The bottom potential here is just like a van der Waal interactions here. If you pay attention, you see you're not using a 6-12, you're using a 10-12. And the reason for that is when you do a C-alpha model, if you do a 6-12, these things start to see residues too far apart. So this is just to keep these things very short range. There's nothing more dramatic on this term. So I have tertiary contacts. And then I have a torsional potential. Right? That put a potential between these dihedral angles that I can put a bias to my secondary structure. So I can buy up tertiary structures by this context, and I can mimic secondary structure by the dihedral angles. This problem showed a difference when you look off lattice models from the lattice models, the following thing. Now we are putting secondary structure. The question now is, how much of your stabilization do you put on the secondary structure, and how much of your stabilization you put on the tertiary context? Let me tell a little bit about it. This has been a big discussion. In principle, I could put a lot of stabilization here and a little bit here. If you put too much stabilization on the dihedral angles, what happens is the secondary structures are totally formed very early. And what you have is these big tubes and helices that cross each other becomes a kinetic nightmare. So it's not an optimal way of doing business. If you put zero here, no bias on the dihedral thing, the only way you're going to get a secondary structure is by the time you make the tertiary contact, they force, they induce the secondary formation. But the search problem becomes enormously large, becomes very hard to design. So we played with different numbers. And you notice that basically, as long you have more or less like 50-50, you can put like 30% here, 70% here, 40% here, 60% here, makes no difference. But what you want to do is, the system has enough tendency to get that secondary structure, but it's not fully committed yet, so it has flexibility. And only when the tertiary contact is made, you lock in. So what we did here is a very simplified potential, where we have the energy about 40% on the secondary structure, but they all go like models. So this is a completely unfrustrated. So I get a protein completely unfrustrated. Actually, here, if I have time, I tell you how much frustration thing can tolerate. You can afterwards start to add frustration. You can do a lot of very interesting studies in basically that's what plotting has been doing by adding noise to this nice result. But let's assume that basically if we believe these things are well done. So how these things work? The first work on this regard actually was done by Jean Cher together with me and Charlie Brooks. And we got a protein here, what we call protein A, that's a very simple protein. And there are a couple things that I want to show on these results. This is just a summary of the result. We measure all the phis for these proteins. What this histogram shows you is how many phis you have that phis between 0 and 0.1, between 0.1 and 0.2, all the way up to 0.6 and 0.7. So that's just a histogram, how many phis you have. And you see that the ending black, green, blue, black, and red are the real large phis of the proteins. This tells you which are the contacts that are required to be formed on the transition state, and which ones are not. What you see is there's a good connection between the kinetic result I show you and the thermodynamic result. It's not perfect, but you see that you're more or less on the ballpark. That's how well do this assumption works. But you do quite well. You can figure out which parts of the protein have to be formed first from here. The nice thing about this result is that basically Charlie Brooks and his group have actually been able to run an all-atom simulation of this protein, where they have everything, and they have the solvent, and they have the entire story, and now they do the free energy profile as a function of few reaction coordinates. Now they use like collapse coordinates, secondary structure, they identify transition state, and they can measure the phis. The phis you measure from the C-alpha model using...
What time do they hear what? From what time? How many nanoseconds?
Which one you're talking about? I'll talk about my simple model or the Brooks model. Okay, Brooks time is not time is not the main concern. What these people do is they want to make sure they are probed the entire configuration space. Since they're not, since they are looking at sampling of the space, what they do is they do some very long runs, Then he creates these particular seed points on the landscape, and then they try to explore these things and get the density of state. And then later on, they create a few other points at random and try to see if these things change the data. So they create a consistent loop with it. But the point you're trying to raise is a very good point, because I think if you really go seriously and investigate all these all-atom simulations, you may wonder if the full sampling is appropriate. And the reason I think the full sampling is working over the system is because proteins are reasonably well designed. If you're not, sampling would be a total nightmare. If you had that many traps, would be a problem. But the way they do it, they first do these very long runs at many different temperatures, they create the seed points, and then they explore on, then they create constrained simulation on each one of the seed points, and then they integrate all these numbers together.
Not obligatory. This technique can work because it is very similar to get pumps.
Yeah. That's right, that's correct. So that's what they have done. But the interesting thing here is when they do all these very large simulations, these files are in a 10% agreement. What you get from all atoms from these things, they come from this model where you have no frustration. It tells you topology is actually what's the determinant factor in here. It's topological effects. So what we did here, let me show you a few results. We apply this model to proteins where people have a lot of experimental data. So take the chance of being completely attacked by Sophie, that has worked on this protein for all her life and knows all the details. Here is CI2. And there's a very interesting thing about CI2. Let me show these figures. Since I'm going to show you several of these figures, I want you to understand the first one, then it's going to be easy. Here, above, you're looking at the protein I'm talking about, CA2. In blue are the beta strands. In red is the alpha helix. Here is what we call a contact map. So each point on this contact map, forget about the colors for a little bit, each point means a tertiary contact on this protein. These are residues that are in contact. So each point here, forgetting about colors, they mean a contact. Actually, the information on this bottom part is equal to information top part. It's just so this is the way people represent this protein, right? And to make your life a little bit simpler, you see that I put in blue the beta strand parts and in red the alpha helix. So it's very easy to see that basically if I come here, if I look at this point here, it's a contact between this helix and this beta strand. So you don't actually have to follow the number. So you can see the protein above and you can follow it, right? The first two small beta strands, then you have the alpha helix, then you have all the other strands up there, and they are in blue down here. So it's a contact map. So each point tells you a tertiary contact. So that tells you a little bit. The reason I have two plots, these are the five values and just the probability of the contact to be in the transition state. So let's look at this one, because then we don't have to worry about the unfolded state. We just see what's the probability of having a contact when you are at the transition state. What you see here is very interesting. If you look on the diagonal, as you move from the diagonal above into this model, you see that you colors mean green, black would be the contact we form with probability 1, white would mean the contact not formed transition state and you have everything in between. You see this protein is a very nice protein with very little problems on what we have been calling topological things. You see that basically the darker colors, they are closer diagonal, and as you get farther from the diagonal, the colors get lighter. That becomes like a very trivial result. Expect the contacts are far apart of the chain. They are harder to make than the contacts are close in the chain. But there's no any particular detail structure that you see into this process. So you see the CI2 is a very nice protein in terms of these topological factors. And these things are qualitative in agreement with experiments. But what I want to point out is this is a protein different than a protein I'm going to show you now, SH3. That's another small protein. What people see experimentally now, you see dark points very far from the diagonal. So you see there's a particular structure, long-range contact, that has to be formed at the transition state, almost probability 1. Otherwise, this protein doesn't get formed. And basically, this thing are the contacts between on this distal loop and interaction with diversion turn, people have actually observed this thing experimentally. And you see that these very simplified simulations get exactly the same result. So you see these real big things that start to appear experimentally, you have a very, very nice correlation. Actually, with these models, now I'm going to do a jump. You can actually go to proteins like RNAs, where people observe not only a three-state folder, but they actually have intermediates. And you can actually now look at the free energy profile, even with a Go model, and you see you have an intermediate. You have the folded state. You shouldn't believe your energetics completely because you're very unfrustrated. But the position of these things, you can actually see it. And what you see is not only the transition state, but if you look the intermediate, if you look the intermediate of this protein, that's here, this is exactly the intermediate people observe experimentally. So see, just by doing simple models, ontologically speaking, the part of the protein that's observed experimentally is formed first at the intermediate, you get here in the same way. So you're seeing topology is a very important thing, and it tells you that you have to, and we don't have a good theory for it. Right now, actually, we are trying to create this, Plotkin is working very hard on trying to put to write this functional free energy method to do these things, but we actually try to work on analytical theory to incorporate this effect. The nice thing about it is to put a protein which has a kinetic trap. And the protein has a kinetic trap here, I want to point, is a protein called QI. And QI is a protein that's, I'm sorry I didn't put a structure of protein, but it's just a protein with five alpha helix they have to pack together. This is a typical kinetic run of QI, and you see that QI, actually, if you follow the simulation, this is just one to bind you. There are two kinds of intermediates. Some of them, they are a trap. You have to get out of them before you fold, and then you have an intermediate one that's actually on the folding route. And we can actually come from these models, well-designed with a funnel-like landscape, and actually try to identify what's the nature of this trap. And see, I have no bad energy here doing a Go model, and I'm getting my trap.
QI actually has two conformations, right? Depending on whether it's
fast forward or not. Here is just like the before that. What I see is changing the end. But here is a real trap on the folding process. And I'm going to show you where this trap comes from. So what you notice on QI, look at the next transparency, and I think that's a very nice thing, is something you notice that basically, here are the two intermediates. The transition state is very similar to the second intermediate, and this is the first trap. That's the trap, the misfolding intermediate. What happens to this protein, even being well designed, is that these alpha helix are very easy to be formed. So what the protein does in our model, and that's exactly what people observe experimentally with Serrano, is that the helix are very easy to form because they're short range contacts. So this protein very fast formed this alpha helix, and you can create these traps where you have all the helix formed, but there's no structure between the alpha helix, right? As you see here, you see the helix, these things are really the helix, this course here are the helix being formed, and there's no structure between them. And in order to do the transition, you see you have to sort of destroy these two helices before you can actually fold, otherwise you cannot make the core of this protein. So you see here in a case that even these two effects have to be played, because even into the system, we are getting to this situation. Now, there are many ways we can go from, which are the more, another thing we have done, I'm just doing another 10 minutes. Another thing you have done is this geometrical or topological effects can actually be probed. And one of the great experimental probes that we have out there are circular permutants. And why circular permutants are great? Circular permutants are great because you get a protein. Imagine this is the shape of protein. And what you do is you connect these two ends of the protein and you cut on some other place. So you have exactly the same shape of the protein. You have exactly the same sequence, it's just the beginning and the end that changes. What's nice about these things, because you see that the energetics of the problem, or the tertiary contacts, and the is about the same. The only thing you're changing is where the beginning and the end of the chain. So if the order of formation of contacts is important, that's a great probe. Because you have exactly the same energetics, and you're doing that, and people can do that experimentally. So, the first protein, there's lots of studies here on these things, again, CI2, that's probably the most well-studied protein on these details. And here is an example of the results. Here's just a cartoon of the result, I don't want to show the details. Here is the protein before, and here's the protein where you cut here and you connect here, right? So you see the two proteins. And you see the lighter part is the part that's weakly formed on the transition state, and right, you see again, going from yellow to red is how large these phi eyes, the probabilities are, and you see there's very little change on CI2. And you expect very little change on CI2, because if you saw our early studies, You didn't see any particular contact that was very important to be formed. You expect the situation to completely change if you go to SH3, and actually it changed. People doing experiment, they noticed that. The similar results for SH3 are here. And what you see here is the wild type. And if you remember about this one, I said the contacts between this part and this loop here, they have to be very well structured in the beginning, otherwise you don't make the core. Remember when I showed you the result. What you can do now is, you can cut here, or you can cut here. And you see basically, when you cut here, the entire structure of colors change. You see a substantial change on the entire phi analysis of this protein as expected. Okay, and you see here, when you cut exactly on this loop, you see this, you see basically, or you cut there, you see this change is happening, right? So you can see that, yes?
So did people do experiments on this?
Yes, and the results are all in agreement with experiments. Yes. On 10% on these phis, we agree on everything.
Can it still follow the same shape?
Yes, folds the same shape, but you see a complete different phi analysis. Very little change for CI2. CI2, the change that you see are just localized on the place that you cut and the place that you connect. But on the rest of the protein, there's very little change. On SH3, as expected, you see a substantial change. So you see, all these things corroborate at this level. Now what I'm trying to say is, the idea that we say that the proteins we have out there are reasonably well designed. Have we proved 100% the case? We haven't, but see, all the indications tells you that these models that are very unfrustrated, remove all these things, we can reproduce all this experimental data. So it gives an idea that you really have this sort of funnel line landscape where most of this heterogeneity on the transition state comes from the shape of the protein or the topology we're seeing at the end and not from being badly designed. Proteins is still reasonably well designed. What? Yes. Actually, we are generalizing our GO model, and what we are doing now is a very interesting system. We say, okay, if I have time, I show all but there actually many intermediate models of GO model. What we have now is what we call our glorified GO model. And the glorified GO model.
So for the non-native interactions, you set a repulsive potential.
That's correct. Okay, Bill raised a good point here. Yes, for the here we have just attractive interactions for the good interactions, and then just the hard sphere for the other ones, just a repulsive hard sphere. That's a very good point because there's a lot of people. Actually, there's a very good work being done by Dave Trumulai and Asim Sheknovich presenting some work now where they say maybe you have some non-native contacts that are required on some intermediate states into the folding process. And clearly, if that's the case, we will be captured with these models. What I'm trying to say is at least the general features we can capture with these models, but as you start going more and more in details, these other things may appear. So what I'm telling you here is I'm making a qualitative agreement between these things, and I think there's a long way when I make this thing quantitative, but I think that's a good zero order model to start to work on.
Another small technical question. What kind of attractive potential are you using between the native residues?
It's the one I showed you before, but I can go back.
It's just a
Van der Waals.
Just a Van der Waals potential?
Actually,
long-range electrostatic.
No long range, it's just a Van der Waals contact. Because
you just look at Van der Waals, you use a Van der Waals contact potential for.
Yes, we are just C alpha, that's right. It's C alphas. And actually, we don't use a 6-12, we use a 10-12 because we want to make sure that it's just residues is local, right? So you're talking about local between these residues. It's a C alpha model, right?
Yeah. So I guess one of the curious things is that it's also saying that long range electrostatic interactions are playing a minor role as well. That would be another conclusion. Not just that non-native interactions are playing a minor role, but long-range electrostatic interactions.
Okay, I'll give myself 10 more minutes, and I'm going to show this glorified GO model, and then I'm going to... Yeah, we'll try to finish, but I'll give just 10... And then we'll show a little bit about the water potential, and then I finish. It's very fast.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Okay, this model here is one thing that basically... we can do now, just show models. The difference here is, instead of using the C alpha model, we actually include all the heavy atoms of the protein. All the heavy atoms, everything that you have. But the potential we include has two parts. You have the non-bonded interactions, we keep from the conventional Amber force field, and the bonded interactions, we take the conventional Van der Waals, and we take the electrostatics out, and we replace by a goal potential. There's a difference. There are two kinds. One for just on the distance, for the hydrogen bonds, and another one for atom-atom contact. But now you have heavy atom-heavy atom interaction, and we set the temperature to have a TF of 340 Kelvin. So the epsilon layer swap to have the right TF. So what you see is very interesting. Here is protein L, and again here you're seeing probability of contacts. And the top half here now shows the results for a C alpha model, and the bottom half shows you results for the when you include all atom potentials. And what you see is, although these results are qualitatively similar, they're not exactly the same. You see the C alpha, the helix is almost formed uniform. Here, you have part of the helix, but part of it's not totally formed. You see that these herpings are on the C alpha model, you have interaction between herpings. On this one here, you see you have interaction of one herping, but then you have interaction between. So there's a slight difference between these two things that you can start to notice as you start to put more details. So qualitatively, the pictures appear to be the same, but quantitatively, you can do a change. And the nice thing about these potentials is actually, since you have all atoms, you can do a better comparison with phi values. Because now we can actually do all the phi values when you have this particular mutation, because now we have all the atoms. So at least at the goal level, we can replace these phenylalanines by the alanines and actually see what changes on the phi analysis. So this is the result that Shishir is just finishing now, so it tells you this is a nice model to connect to these things to the results. And basically, what you see here, just look at this one, don't worry about this part here. What you see here is comparison between phis that come from simulation and phis experimental. And you can see how they correlate. But the nice thing about it is the comparison between simulation and one experiment is in blue. And in red is the comparison between two different experiments where people did different mutations for these phis. There are two different series of phis that comes for this protein. May I doing other different mutations, so get two different papers. So you see that basically that's the level of agreement that you can do doing these things today. But I think it's very good for us to understand the overall features of folding, but that's where we are. And now with even so, Orlan for good reason wants to kill me, I'm going to show two more transparencies and I'll finish. The only two transparencies I want to show is the fact that basically, like Bill raised a good point, our potentials have been included. We took all the electrostatic out, and we don't have explicit solvent. But in collaboration with Angel Garcia in Los Alamos, we have to create a potential where actually you can put water in between. And although the water is not explicitly represented, you can do it. These are very nice simulations because you can develop these potentials by starting with a box full of water, and now you compute the probability of open cavities inside of this water, and from this probability, you can get what's the potential between two hydrostatic balls. Here we put size about 3 angstrom inside of these two things. So what you see is you get one minimum, that's when these two things are in contact, and you have a second minimum when they call the water separate minimum. And we can show actually when you apply pressure on these PMFs that this minimum goes up and this minimum becomes the stable one. So you can actually with a very good agreement, get a good agreement with pressure denaturation. But these are models using full solvation. So what we're doing now is that these are sort of the next level potentials. We're not just including contacts. They're just like a single van der Waals, but we're including contacts where you add this probability of putting water in and out. And to show you a result of these simulations, I won't go on details, I'm just showing the end of it, the story. The end of the story, we did the simulation for SH3. And now what the free energy profiles we get, let me show you a little bit about this free energy profile, is here. Just look the top one. Here is a Q, the conventional Q you have. Dark colors means that they're more stable. The yellowish means they're higher energy, since it's a two-dimensional profile. Here is the conventional Q. Here is what we call pseudo Q. And pseudo Q is when you have a water separate minimum. Right, so what you see is you come from this minima, you overcome this barrier, and in the end you squeeze the final water out. Actually, at least for SH3, and since it's just a very preliminary data, I don't want to get into there. Most of these things, the barrier doesn't come from squeezing the water out, come from making those contacts, but you have a final step where you have to squeeze this water out. And you see, this is this downhill scenario we have here, and actually we're looking at these dynamics to see if this is downhill or if there is a barrier here. When we, this is something Margaret's studying. To have an idea of this result here, here is
the radius of gyration of the object where the water is squeezed out.
Yes, you can actually see. This is the result of the state at the, about it a little bit after the transition state. You see that this contact I have here between the distal loop and the diverging turn, they actually formed. This part's entire form. This red part is the core of the protein. You have lots of water in between. So what you have is a transition state on this model that you're starting to notice where these high phi values have to be formed, and on the last step, you have to squeeze the water out. It's still a simplified potential, but these are the things we start to observe in models like that. I didn't have time to tell you about all atom simulations, but I hope that at least I give you a view of what the idea of energy landscapes coming from. It's basically, it's a very nice theoretical framework that gave a ways of us thinking about how the mechanisms come. So when you think about funnels, it's not a question basically, oh, what's exactly the funnel? The funnel is a concept that helps you to validate this connection between these free energy profiles, a function of free reaction coordinates, and the kinetics, and a view. And we can show that a lot of the experimental data wouldn't be valid unless these sort of landscapes existed. What I didn't do today, and I apologize, is actually I've been doing a lot of very nice analytical work, because I can tell everybody here, see, since you believe these things are reasonably simple and are robust, a lot of the things that you're spending tons of times on computer, you can actually do analytic if you're smart enough and write the right form for the entropy and things like that. And Plotkin is working very hard in collaboration with Chichita to get some of these ideas together. There's no reason why you couldn't do it. There's some complications, or how to reduce loop entropy, how you do the mixing entropy, but there's nothing potentially impossible, but that's a nice field that you're developing now. And the other thing is, I didn't talk about atom simulation, but the connection between these two parts is also very interesting to figure out what are we missing when you put all the details. But then on atom simulation, we have the discussion of the force field appropriates and stuff like that. But with that said, I stop here since I talked for too long. Thank you.
So when you put in this potential of mean force, to, which gives you this additional minimum, and gives you this sulfated transition state from the core, what's the output of the calculation? Does the phi values are even better with the experiment or worse?
The phi values are actually in fairly good agreement, at least the high phi values.
Better or worse than when you excluded the, when you didn't have the potential of mean force?
Okay. The reason we haven't computed all of them yet, so we should compute them and do a calculation. I don't expect to see a substantial change, and let me tell you why. Because the region that's actually the high phi region
doesn't have
this is formed, and actually it's very interesting that this region has to get formed. And the interesting thing is that your core still has the water in there, so the last step is to squeeze this thing. The one thing you're more interested now, and I think it's a very interesting question, and we haven't addressed perfectly yet, is as you squeeze this water out, clear the barrier of the free energy profile. We know from kinetics that that's the rate determined step. What determines most of the folding time, at least of this protein, is to go over the barrier, and what determines a lot of the barrier is the formation of this contacts, because this is a requirement for SH3. But we don't know if this is a problem because H3 has this big topological constraint, or is the other one. But if you look on the free energy profile, it appears that squeezing this water out after you form these things and the core is formed appears to be kind of, at least on that very low resolution, it's almost like a downhill process. We are studying the kinetics very carefully to see exactly how these things work into this model. But actually, I think it's something that makes a lot of sense at the time you start to work with these proteins. Because you can see that on this protein, and you start to see that you're unable. If you look at folding of SH3, you almost can do that. It's like in parts in two dimensions, and then you fold this two-dimensional thing into the shape. And you cannot put this core together unless you bring these two parts together. There's no way. That's why you have this large phi there. And then after you bring this core together, then the last step of folding is to expel this water out. But this is interesting things because I think there are a lot of things you can actually probe, because when you start to look, there's a bunch of experimental data where people look where the waters into the transition state of SH3. So you start to look at the data where they have NMR data for looking solvation and around this area. But let's stop here.
Does this observation represent entropy-driven hydrophobic effect?
Okay, all right, that's a very good point, and we haven't addressed it directly, because the way we do here, we cheat, right? Because if you see, basically, yes, most of it's entropy, but we put this into this effective potential, because the contact potential we came from these simulations, where we figure out part of, see, this potential has two parts. One part that comes from the probability of opening the cavities inside of the solvation. So I start with a box full of water, and if you have pressure, you have to change the pressure, and you compute the probability of opening these boxes inside of water. The reason you have this big barrier here is because if you don't feed the water, you have to have vacuum in between, and that has a big entropy cost. So a lot of this potential, of this effective potential, is entropic. And it is, in a sense, an effect that comes from what you call hydrophobic potential. But by the time we do our simulation, we just use this potential of mean force as the effective potential. But this term is intrinsically there when this potential was developed there. And by the way, I'm more a user of this potential than actually developer of this potential. I got very interested when I saw these papers coming out. It's actually developed by Gerhard Hummer and Angel Garcia and Dave Pratt. Hummer is with Bill Whitman and NIH now. He's a very bright person. So basically, I'm just this distiller that's getting this potential, because it's a. And actually, it's a very nice problem to work on, because it, particularly the pressure denaturation, you see that basically the entire part of the probability of these holes, when you apply pressure, they move a little bit to the left, and that's what makes this minimum to go up. And that's exactly what you see on proteins. When you apply pressure, at some point, if this minimum, the hard core doesn't change, right? So it's just the water packing that changes with pressure, and that's where you see these two minimums competing.
Thanks again.